A warm summer day in the cool grass, with the sun high in the cloudless sky, the air coming off the water, carrying the freshness of the sea. A man walks up to the house, briefcase in hand. A younger man, brown hair cut short, freshly shaven, dressed casually. A sense of nervousness by the way he switches his briefcase from one hand to the other, and the thin layer of sweat glistening on his forehead. He knocks at the door. My grandfather answers, opens the door for the man to enter, then closes it behind him. I resume my romping in the yard. Hadley changing forms, flying, then dodging, then charging, wrestling with one another, and laughing until it hurts. The day passing as only time can under the reckless abandon of childhood's invincibility, of its innocence. 15 minutes pass. Maybe less. At that age, a day can last forever. The door opens and closes. I look up. My grandfather is standing with the man I had seen approach, both of them looking down at me.
There is somebody I would like you to meet, he says.
I stand from the grass and clap my hands together to knock away the dirt.
This is Brandon, my grandfather says. He is your sapon. Do you know what that means?
I shake my head. Brandon. That was his name. All these years and only now does it come back to me.
It means he's going to be spending a lot of time with you from here on out. The two of you. It means you are connected. You are bound to one another. Do you understand?
I nod and walk to the man, and I offer him my hand as I have seen done many times by grown men before. The man smiles and drops to one knee. He takes my small hand in his right, and he closes his fingers around it.
Pleased to meet you, sir, I say.
Bright, kind eyes full of life look into mine, as though offering a promise, a bond. Yet I'm too young to know what that promise or bond really means. He nods and brings his left hand on top of his right, my tiny hand lost somewhere in the middle. He nods at me, still smiling.
My dear child, he says, the pleasure is all mine.
I am jolted awake. I lie on my back, my heart racing, breathing heavily, as though I had been running. My eyes stay closed, but I can tell the sun has just risen by the long shadows and the crispness of air in the room. Pain returns, my limbs still heavy. With the pain comes another pain, a pain far greater than any physical ailment I could ever be afflicted with. The memory of the hours before. I take a deep breath and exhale. A single tear rolls down the side of my face. I keep my eyes closed. An irrational hope that if I don't find the day, then the day won't find me. That the things in the night will be nullified. My body shudders, a silent cry, turning into a hard one. I shake my head and let it in. I know that Henri is dead, and that all the hope in the world won't change it. I feel movement beside me. I tense myself, try to remain motionless so as not to be detected. A hand reaches up and touches the side of my face, a delicate touch done with love. My eyes come open, adjusting to the post-dawn light, until the ceiling of a foreign room comes into focus. I have no idea where I am, nor how I could have gotten here. Sarah is sitting next to me. She brings her hand to the side of my face and traces my brow with her thumb. She leans down and kisses me, a soft, lingering kiss that I wish I could bottle and save for all time. She pulls away, and I take a deep breath and close my eyes and kiss her on the forehead.
Where are we?
I ask.
A hotel 30 miles from paradise?
How did I get here?
Sam drove us, she says.
I mean from the school.
What happened?
I remember that you were with me last night, but I don't remember a thing after, I say. It almost seems like a dream.
I waited on the field with you until Mark arrived, and he carried you to Sam's truck. I couldn't stay hidden any longer. Being in the school without knowing what was happening out there was killing me, and I felt like I could help somehow.
You certainly helped, I say.
You saved my life. I killed an alien, she says, as though the fact still hasn't settled in.
She wraps her arms around me, her hand resting on the back of my head. I try to sit up. I make it halfway on my own, and then Sarah helps me the rest of the way, pushing on my back but being careful not to touch the wound left by the knife. I swing my feet over the edge of the bed and reach down and feel the scars around my ankle, counting them with the tips of my fingers. Still only 3. And in this way, I know that 6 has survived. I had already accepted the fate of the rest of my days being spent alone, an itinerant wanderer, with no place to go. But I won't be alone. 6 is still here, still with me, my tie to a past world.
Is 6 okay? Yes, she says. She's been stabbed and shot, but she seems to be doing okay now. I don't think she would have survived had Sam not carried her to the truck.
Where is she?
In the room next door, with Sam and Mark.
I stand. My muscles and joints ache in protest, everything stiff and sore. I am wearing a clean t-shirt, a pair of mesh shorts. My skin is fresh with the smell of soap. The cuts have been cleaned and bandaged, a few of them stitched.
Did you do all of this?
I ask.
Most of it. The stitches were hard. We only had the ones Henri put in your head to go on as an example. Sam helped with them.
I look at Sarah, sitting on the bed, her legs pulled underneath her. Something else catches my eye. A small mass that is shifted beneath the blanket at the foot of the bed. I tense, and immediately my mind returns to the weasels that sped across the gym. Sarah sees what I am looking at and smiles. She crawls to the bottom of the bed on her hands and knees.
There's somebody who wants to say hello, she says,
then takes the corner of the blanket and gently peels it back to reveal Bernie Kosar sleeping away. A metal splint goes the length of his front leg, and his body is covered with cuts and gashes that, like mine, have been cleaned and are already beginning to heal. His eyes slowly open and adjust, eyes rimmed with red, full of exhaustion. He keeps his head on the bed, but his tail gives a subtle wag, softly thumping against the mattress.
Bernie,
I say, and drop to my knees before him. I place my hand softly on his head. I can't stop smiling, and tears of joy surface. His small body is curled into a ball, head resting on his front paws, his eyes taking me in. Battle-scarred and wounded, but still here to tell the tale.
Bernie Kosar, you made it through! I owe my life to you,
I say, and kiss the top of his head. Sarah runs her hand down the length of his back.
I carried him to the truck while Mark carried you.
Mark, I'm sorry I ever doubted him, I say. She lifts one of Bernie Kosar's ears. He turns and sniffs at her hand, and then licks it.
So, is it true what Mark said? That Bernie Kosar grew to 30 feet tall and killed a beast almost double his size?
I smile. A beast triple his size. Bernie Kosar looks at me. Liar, he says. I look down and wink at him. I stand back up and look at Sarah.
All of this, I say. All of this has happened so fast. How are you handling it?
She nods.
Handling what? The fact that I've fallen in love with an alien, which I only found out about 3 days ago, and then just happened to walk headlong into the middle of a war? Yeah, I'm handling that okay.
I smile at her.
You're an angel. Nah, she says. I'm just a girl crazy in love.
She gets up from the bed and wraps her arms around me, and we stand in the center of the room holding one another.
You really have to leave, don't you?
I nod.
She takes a deep breath and exhales shakily,
willing herself not to cry.
More tears in the past 24 hours than I have ever witnessed in all the years of my life. I don't know where you have to go or what you have to do, but I'll wait for you, John. Every bit of my heart belongs to you, whether you ask for it or not.
I pull her to me. And mine belongs to you, I say. I walk across the room. Sitting on top of the desk are the Lorik chest, 3 packed bags, Henri's computer, and all the money from the last withdrawal he made at the bank. Sarah must have rescued the chest from the home ec room. I place my hand on it. All the secrets, Henri had said. All of them contained within this. In time I'll open it and discover them, but that time is certainly not now. And what did he mean about paradise? That her coming wasn't by chance.
Did you pack my bags?
I ask Sarah, who was standing behind me.
Yes, and it was probably the hardest thing I ever had to do.
I lift my bag from the table. Beneath it is a manila envelope carrying my name across the front of it.
What is this?
I ask.
I don't know. I found it in Henri's bedroom. We went there after leaving the school and tried to grab everything we could. Then we came here.
I open the envelope and pull out the contents. All of the documents Henri had created for me. Birth certificates, social security cards, visas, and so on. I count through them. 17 different identities. 17 different ages. On the very front sheet is a sticky note in Henri's writing. It reads, "Just in case." After the last sheet is another sealed envelope, across which Henri has written my name. A letter, the one he must have been talking about just before he died. I don't have the heart to read it now. I look out the window of the hotel room. A light snow sifts down from the low gray clouds overhead. The ground is too warm for any of it to stick. Sarah's car and Sam's father's blue truck are parked beside each other in the lot. As I stand looking down at them, a knock sounds at the door. Sarah opens it, and Sam and Mark walk into the room. 6 limps behind them. Sam hugs me, says he's sorry.
"Thank you," I say.
"How do you feel?"
6 asks. She is no longer wearing the suit, but is now dressed in the pair of jeans she wore when I first saw her, and one of Henri's sweatshirts. I shrug.
I'm okay.
Sore and stiff. My body feels heavy.
The heaviness is from the dagger. It'll eventually wear off, though.
How badly were you stabbed? I ask. She lifts her shirt and shows me the gash in her side, then a different one on her back. All told, she was stabbed 3 times last night, and that's not to mention the various cuts along the rest of her body, or the shot that left a deep gash in her right thigh, now wrapped tightly with gauze and tape, the reason for her limp. She tells me that by the time we made it back, it was too late to be healed by the stone. It amazes me that she is even alive. Sam and Mark are wearing the same clothes as the day before, both filthy and covered in mud and dirt with smatterings of blood mixed in. Both with heavy eyes, as though they've yet to sleep. Mark stands behind Sam, shifting his weight uncomfortably.
"Sam, I always knew you were a wrecking machine," I say. He laughs uncertainly.
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine," I say. "How about you?"
"Doing okay.
I look over his shoulder at Mark.
Sarah told me you carried me off the field last night.
Mark shrugs.
I was happy to help.
You saved my life, Mark. He looks me in the eye.
I think every one of us saved somebody at some point last night. Hell, Six saved me on 3 separate occasions, and you saved my 2 dogs on Saturday. I say we're even.
I somehow manage to smile.
Fair enough, I say. I'm just happy to find out you're not the dick I thought you were. He half grins.
Let's just say that had I known you were an alien and could kick my ass at will, I might have been a little nicer to you that first day.
Six walks across the room and looks at my bags atop the table.
We really should get going,
she says, and then looks at me with implicit concern, her face softening.
There's really only one thing left undone. We weren't sure what you wanted us to do.
I nod. I don't need to ask to know what she is talking about. I look at Sarah. It's going to happen much sooner than I thought. My stomach turns. I feel as though I could vomit. Sarah reaches out and takes hold of my hand.
Where is he?
The ground is damp with the melting snow. I hold Sarah's hand in mine, and we pass through the woods in silence, a mile away from the hotel. Sam and Mark walk in the lead, following the muddy footprints they created a few hours before. Up ahead, I see a slight clearing, in the center of which, Henri's body has been laid out on a slab of wood. He is wrapped in the gray blanket pulled from his bed. I walk to him. Sarah follows and places a hand on my shoulder. The others stand behind me. I pull the blanket down to see him. His eyes are closed. His face is ashen gray, and his lips are blue from the cold. I kiss his forehead.
What do you want to do, John?
Six asks.
We can bury him if you want. We can also cremate him.
How can we cremate him?
I can create a fire.
I thought you could only control the weather.
Not the weather, the elements.
I look up at her soft face, concern written upon it, but also the stress of time at our having to leave before reinforcements arrive. I don't answer. I look away and squeeze Henri a final time, with my face close to his, and I lose myself to grief.
I'm so sorry, Henri.
I whisper in his ear. I close my eyes.
I love you. I wouldn't have missed a second of it either. Not for anything.
I whisper. I'm going to take you back yet. Somehow, I am going to get you back to Lorien. We always joked about it. You are my father, the best father I could have ever asked for. I'll never forget you. Not for a minute. For as long as I live, I love you, Henri. I always did. I let go of him, pull the blanket back over his face, and lay him gently on the wooden slab. I stand and hug Sarah. She holds me until I stop crying. I wipe the tears away with the back of my hand and I nod at Six. Sam helps me clear away the sticks and leaves, and then we lay Henri's body on the ground, so as not to dilute his ash with anything else. Sam lights an edge of the blanket, and Six makes the fire rage from there. We watch it burn. Not a dry eye among us. Even Mark cries. Nobody says a word. When the flames end, I gather the ashes in a coffee can that Mark was astute enough to bring from the hotel. I'll get something better the second we stop. When we walk back, I put the can on the dashboard of Sam's dad's truck. I feel comforted to know that Henri will still travel with us, that he'll look out over the roads while we leave another town, as the two of us have done so many times before. We load our belongings into the back of the truck, along with Six's things and mine. Sam has also loaded in 2 bags of his own,
At first I'm confused, but then I realize that between him and Six, some agreement has been made that Sam will come with us. And I'm happy for that. Sarah and I walk back into the hotel room. The second the door closes, she takes my hand and turns me towards her.
"My heart is breaking," she says. "I want to be strong for you right now, but the thought of you leaving is killing me inside."
I kiss her on the head.
"My heart is broken already," I say.
"The second I get settled, I'll write.
And I'll do my best to call when I know it is safe."
Six pokes her head in the doorway.
"We really have to go," she says.
I nod. She closes the door. Sarah lifts her face to mine, and we stand kissing there in the hotel room. The thought of the Mogadorians returning before we have left, and thus putting her in danger yet again, is the only source of strength I can find. Else I might collapse. Else I might stay forever. Bernie Kosar still lies waiting at the foot of the bed. He wags his tail when I carefully take him into my arms and carry him outside to the truck. Six starts the truck and lets it idle. I turn and look up at the hotel, and I'm saddened that it's not the house, and that I know I'll never see it again. It's peeling wooden clapboards, broken windows, black shingles warped from excessive sun exposure and rain. It looks like paradise, I once told Henri. But that will no longer hold true. Paradise lost. I turn and nod to Six. She climbs into the truck, closes the door, and waits. Sam and Mark shake hands, but I don't hear what they say to each other. Sam climbs into the truck and waits with Six. I shake Mark's hand.
"I owe you more than I'll ever be able to repay," I say to Mark. "You don't owe me a thing," Mark says.
"Not true," I say. "Someday." I look away. I can feel myself wanting to collapse under the sadness of leaving. My resolve is being held by a tattered string ready to snap. I nod. "I'll see you again someday."
"Be safe out there."
I take Sarah into my arms and squeeze her tightly, never wanting to let go. "I'll come back to you," I say. "I promise you, if it's the last thing I do, I'll come back to you." Her face is buried in my neck. She nods.
"I'll count the minutes until you do," she says.
One last kiss. I set her on the ground and I open the door to the truck. My eyes never leave hers. She covers her mouth and her nose with her hands pressed together. Neither one of us able to look away. I close the door. Six puts the truck in reverse and pulls out of the parking lot. Comes to a stop, puts it in gear. Mark and Sarah walk to the end of the lot to watch us on our way. Tears streaming down both sides of Sarah's face. I turn in my seat and watch from the rear window. I lift my hand to wave, and Mark waves back, but Sarah just watches. I watch her for as long as I can, growing smaller. One indistinct blur fading in the distance. The truck slows and turns, and both of them vanish from sight. I turn back around and I watch the fields pass, and I close my eyes, and I picture Sarah's face, and I smile. "We'll be together yet," I tell her. "And until that day, you'll be in my heart and my every thought." Bernie Kosar lifts his head and rests it in my lap, and I place my hand upon his back. The truck bounces down the road, driving south. The four of us, together, heading for the next town, wherever that might be.
And now, a sneak listen to the first chapter of the next book in the series. Enjoy.
Harper Audio presents The Power of Six by Pittacus Lore, performed by Neil Kaplan and Marisol Ramirez.
The events in this book are real. Names and places have been changed to protect the Lorien Six, who remain in hiding. Other civilizations do exist. Some of them seek to destroy you. Chapter 1. My name is Marina, as of the sea, but I wasn't called that until much later. In the beginning, I was known merely as Seven, one of the nine surviving guard from the planet Lorien, the fate of which was, and still is, left in our hands. Those of us who aren't lost. Those of us still alive. I was six when we landed, when the ship jolted to a halt on Earth. Even at my young age, I sensed how much was at stake for us. Nine Saipan, nine guard, and that our only chance waited for us here. We had entered the planet's atmosphere in the midst of a storm of our own creation, and as our feet found Earth for the very first time, I remember the wisps of steam that rolled off the ship and the goosebumps that covered my arms. I hadn't felt the wind in a year, and it was freezing outside. Somebody was there waiting for us. I don't know who he was, only that he handed each Saipan two sets of clothes and a large envelope. I still don't know what was in it. As a group, we huddled together, knowing we might never see one another again. Words were spoken, hugs were given, and then we split up, as we knew we must, walking in pairs in nine different directions. I kept peering over my shoulder as the others receded in the distance, until very slowly, one by one, they all disappeared. And then it was just Adelina and me, alone. I realize now just how scared Adelina must have been. I remember boarding a ship headed to some unknown destination. I remember two or three different trains after that. Adelina and I kept to ourselves, huddled against each other in obscure corners, away from whoever might be around. We hiked from town to town, over mountains and across fields, knocking on doors that were quickly slammed in our faces. We were hungry, tired, and scared. I remember sitting on a sidewalk, begging for change. I remember crying instead of sleeping. I'm certain that Adelina gave away some of our precious gems from Lorien for nothing more than warm meals, so great was our need. Perhaps she gave them all away. And then we found this place in Spain. A stern-looking woman I would come to know as Sister Lucia answered the heavy oak door. She squinted at Adelina, taking in her desperation, the way her shoulders drooped. "Do you believe in the word of God?" the woman asked in Spanish, pursing her lips and narrowing her eyes in scrutiny. "The word of God is my vow," Adelina replied with a solemn nod. I don't know how she knew this response. Perhaps she learned it when we stayed in a church basement weeks before. But it was the right one. Sister Lucia opened the door. We've been here ever since. 11 years in the stone convent with its musty rooms, drafty hallways, and hard floors like slabs of ice. Aside from the few visitors, the internet is my only source to the world outside our small town, and I search it constantly, looking for some indication that the others are out there, that they're searching, maybe fighting. Some sign that I'm not alone, because at this point, I can't say that Adelina still believes, that she's still with me. Her attitude changed somewhere over the mountains. Maybe it was with the slam of one of the doors that shut a starving woman and her child out in the cold for another night,
whatever it was, Adelina seems to have lost the urgency of staying on the move, and her faith in the resurgence of Lorien seems to have been replaced by the faith shared by the convent sisters. I remember a distinct shift in Adelina's eyes. Her sudden speeches on the need for guidance and structure if we were to survive. My faith in Lorien remains intact. In India, a year and a half ago, 4 different people witnessed a boy move objects with his mind. While the significance behind the event was small at first, the boy's abrupt disappearance shortly thereafter created much buzz in the region, and a hunt for him began. As far as I know, he hasn't been found. A few months ago, there was news of a girl in Argentina who, in the wake of an earthquake, lifted a 5-ton slab of concrete to save a man trapped beneath it. And when news of this heroic act spread, she disappeared. Like the boy in India, she's still missing. And then there's the father-son duo making all the news now in America, in Ohio, who the police are hunting after the two allegedly demolished an entire school by themselves, killing 5 people in the process. They left no trace behind other than mysterious heaps of ash. It looks like a battle took place here. I don't know how else to explain it, the head investigator was quoted as saying. But make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this. And we will find Henri Smith and his son John. Perhaps John Smith, if that's his real name, is merely a boy with a grudge who was pushed too far. But I don't think that's the case. My heart races whenever his picture appears on my screen. I'm gripped with a profound desperation that I can't quite explain. I can feel it in my bones that he's one of us. And I know somehow that I must find him.
This recording of I Am Number 4 by Pittacus Lore was produced and directed by Bob Dion and performed by Neil Kaplan. It was recorded, edited, mixed, and mastered by Dion Audio Services, Inc. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.